The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week, we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Oscar Edmondson, and on the podcast this week, Richard Madeley reads his diary, Kate Andrews reads her column on how Kate Gate gripped America, Lloyd Evans warns us never to meddle with Shakespeare, Sam McPhail discusses how Johan Cruyff's philosophy changed modern football, and finally, Graham Thompson reads his arts lead, which is an interview with Roxy Music's Phil Manzanera. Up first, Richard Madeley.
To W12 to be in W1A. The spoof TV series on internal BBC politics. What about vanishingly rare UK television species? A comedy that's actually funny. Filmed a special episode for Red Nose Day. It poked genial fun at Lenny Henry's final appearance as comic relief host after nearly 40 years at the helm. I featured as myself, cockily pitching for his job in front of an increasingly outraged Lenny. Richard Curtis's script was hilarious, but filming was a surreal experience. Not because I was in the same room as the W1A cast, all in character, as appalling BBC apparatchiks, but because we really were in the equivalent of W1A. The BBC's offices in Wood Lane, Shepherd's Bush. Art imitating life, imitating art. I guess it felt weird because, as anyone who's been there will tell you, there really is a BBC atmosphere about the place. You feel it. You almost smell it the moment you walk through the door. The ambiance is utterly different to the other half of Television Centre, which of course is now occupied by ITV, and shows such as Good Morning Britain and This Morning. There, it's all hustle, bustle, and a sort of commercial flashiness. But inside the BBC tent, there's a kind of haughty torpor, a steady state aura of unmistakable entitlement. All of which lent itself perfectly to our sketch. As Hugh Bonville's smugly self-satisfied executive puts it, whenever corporate catastrophe is just played out under his watch. So, that's all good then. Last September, a bout of COVID contracted in France left me deaf in one ear. After I was no longer infectious, I took the short-haul flight back home. Big mistake. A build-up of fluid behind my right eardrum burst it as the cabin air pressure fluctuated in flight. Perforated eardrums, my hearing consultant reassured me, almost always repair themselves. I just had to be patient. But it turned out it was everybody else who had to be patient. Conversations were now peppered with, "Pardon? What? Say again. Speak up." It drove my wife mad. And the sensation of deafness on only one side meant that my world was seemingly permanently off kilter. Try walking around with a finger stuck in one ear and you'll see what I mean. Meanwhile, conducting interviews during my stints co-hosting Good Morning Britain became secret exercises in lip-reading. Likewise, conversations in crowded restaurants and pubs. I became skilled at pretending that I'd heard what people had just said, laughing at jokes with inaudible punchlines, agreeing with waiters to try the special of the day when I had no idea if it were fish or fowl. 5 months into my muted new world and there was zero improvement. And then, literally, overnight, my hearing has returned. I went to bed deaf, woke up to hear the birds singing outside. Perforation miraculously healed. So, if it happens to you, hang on in there. Nil desperandum. Earl Spencer would probably have got along quite well with my dad. They had something significant in common. Both went to crummy boarding schools, where they endured experiences that would sear their lives forever. In his memoir, A Very Private School, Princess Diana's younger brother has written about the abuse he suffered at Maidwell Hall Prep, where he was sexually assaulted by staff, bullied, isolated, and desperately lonely. The book is a creed de coeur, and it should give anybody considering sending their child away to be educated a little pause for thought. My dad's little corner of hell was a rundown school called Denston in Staffordshire. A country boy, he was dispatched there aged 15 in the middle of the Second World War. Why? Because his local vicar had seen him kissing a girl in the churchyard and recommended a dose of stiff discipline to stop this slide into debauchery. My father was never as explicit about the abuse that he suffered as Charles Spencer has courageously been, but reading between the lines, it undoubtedly involved sexual assault and sadistic canings. Whatever he went through, he would regularly wake up screaming at night for the rest of his life. Denston dreams, my mother called them. Spencer has called for a national debate into the ethics of sending children to boarding school. Some families have already had it. I'm back on Good Morning Britain presenting duties on Monday. As you may know, it's become a 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off gig that I share with Ed Balls. We take turns, mostly partnering Susanna Reid. Sometimes Rob Render or Adil Ray sits beside her. Susanna has the perfect answer to anyone asking if she has a preference in co-hosts. Channeling her inner Bruce Forsyth, she smiles sweetly and replies, "They're all my favourites."
That was Richard Madeley. Next, Kate Andrews.
Has Kate Middleton united America? For the past few days, we have been one nation under her spell. The Princess of Wales has dominated Google searches in the United States ever since Kensington Palace released the now notorious doctored photo of her with her children for Mother's Day. Her name search beat that of both Donald Trump and Joe Biden over the past week. To say she has broken the internet would only be the start of it. Rumors of her well-being are making their way into every newsroom, dive bar, and church fellowship hour across America. My friends from all over the country text and call me to ask the same question. What's happened to Kate? They know I'm as removed from the royal family as anybody could be, but I'm in London and I work in Westminster, so they hope I've heard a theory that hasn't made its way across the pond just yet. Left liberal pals who usually text me when Trump says something obscene now want to know when I last walked by Buckingham Palace. Did anything seem strange? More right-leaning friends, who tend to send videos of Biden jumbling his words, want to know if it's unusual in Britain to not wear your wedding ring. Or does someone Photoshop her ring out of the Mother's Day photo too? Is that even her hand in the picture? I wonder if Kate knows she has achieved the impossible in bringing America together in this way. I suppose that depends on where she's been, how she's been faring, and how much she's checking the news. All questions that largely remain unanswered. Either way, it's an impressive feat and a wonderful service she has performed. Sure, it would be nice if existential threats to the United States and its citizens were cause enough for us to find common ground, but I'm not going to be picky. I will forever be grateful for this smidgen of evidence that, if the cause is compelling enough, America can pull itself back from the brink. How did Kate Gate go viral in a nation that isn't even her own? The princess's prolonged absence from public life has the right components to capture America's imagination. We are a country obsessed with the crown and true crime. Since we rejected the British monarchy almost 250 years ago, we have rarely had the opportunity to combine the two. The mystery of Kate's movements and the online sleuthing required to discredit that photograph proved to be the golden moment. But it's the cover-up elements which make the story stratospheric. Like everything else in the States, conspiracy theories tend to be big. The more far-fetched, the more viral they go. Trump is QAnon talk has never appealed to the nonpartisan Instagram girlies, but speculation around a princess's whereabouts make for a perfect 20-part video series to add to your highlights reel. That's because Kate Gate is not your traditional conspiracy fair. The big questions, what's happened to Kate, where has she been, have not been whipped up from nothing. Suspicion has been fed by a number of public relations mishandlings from the palace. Stories have changed, a photo has been botched, and is still being censored on social media. This is particularly strange given the normal PR slickness of the firm, a protective, ruthless operation that presidents and pop stars envy. Some of the rumors have taken absurd and dangerous turns, but it's not only fantasists who have questions. Something seems to be happening. We just don't know what. We may never find out what Kate has been up to these past months, and perhaps we shouldn't. Her medical issues aren't our business, after all. But we know what's happened to her in the eyes of the public. Brand Kate has skyrocketed. She and her family have become even more intriguing. The Prince and Princess of Wales's Instagram and X accounts gained more than 200,000 followers combined in the days after the doctored photo was posted. That intrigue has made the princess all the more sensational. Kate is now a mega celebrity. She has the kind of fame her sister craved so badly. Meghan Markle's tactic was to shout from the rooftops, to make herself and her point of view heard through every media platform and streaming service that showed any interest. It worked for a while. Had a pandemic not scuppered her big moment, Mexit would have been the story of 2020. She and Harry still got to sit down with Oprah. Netflix charted their journey from the palace to the Hollywood Hills. But attention quickly waned. This week, the Duchess finds herself doing what every fame hustler must do in the fight for survival, launching a lifestyle brand. Her California-inspired venture, called American Riviera Orchard, will be offering us fashion advice and gardening tips, along with another outlet selling artisan jams and yoga gear. Yet as Meghan pushes the cutlery and cookbooks, it's absent Kate whose face is projected all over the world, a testament, if there ever was one, to the power of silence. Given the long line of mess-ups from the palace, this boost for Kate is a fairly good outcome. The princess disappeared for a few months, and the world made its message clear. We simply can't bear to be without her. When she returns to public life, she will be more adored and loved than ever. The rumors and theories will die down. The outpouring of support for the Princess of Wales will continue. It seems likely she will, as promised, resume public duty in the spring. The future Queen of England will return, radiant as ever, to stand next to her future king and her family, as if nothing ever happened. We'll watch on, always with the niggling feeling that there was something we weren't told, and that not knowing is the key to the charm. As Walter Badgett said, we must not let in daylight upon magic. Or Photoshop, for that matter.
That was Kate Andrews. Next, Lloyd Evans.
A strip club, a prison, a mental asylum, a Great Wall Field Hospital, an addiction clinic, or a Napoleonic palace. These are the typical locations for a modern production of Shakespeare, whose interpreters seem to agree that any setting is better than the one chosen by the playwright. The assumption today is that the bard needs help from directors who can see where he went wrong and know how to get his ideas across with greater force and clarity. Aside from the Greek tragedians, no other playwright attracts this sort of condescending vandalism. If a director were to set the Cherry Orchard on a spaceship or in a Guyanese penal colony, he'd be asked to see a psychiatrist. If he did the same with The Tempest, he'd be given a grant from the local council. Shakespeare has become the useful idiot of activists and social engineers for two main reasons. First, his top dog status as the greatest artist ever to use the English language as his instrument. Secondly, his habit of absenting himself from his plays and leaving us to guess what he really thought or felt. Into this void, the director can insert his own ideas, which instantly acquire the lustre of Shakespeare's authority. The bard is often criticised for his neglect of women, whom he fobbed off with far too few decent roles. This is particularly noticeable in the cycle of Henry plays, where women are represented by the pub landlady, Mistress Quickly, and a couple of drunken trollops. To correct the imbalance, all female versions of the Henry cycle have become popular, which is due in part to Phillida Lloyd's acclaimed productions of the Donmar in 2015, starring Harriet Walter. Shakespeare also sinned against the diversity gods by creating only two title roles for people of colour. Worse still, the African lineage of Cleopatra has been questioned by historians who claim that she and her forebears were all Macedonian. Leaves just one Shakespearean hero with an indisputable African heritage. The easiest way to make Othello more inclusive is to surround them all with black actors in the roles of Rodrigo, Michael Cassio, the Duke of Venice, and so on. This is standard practice nowadays, even though it undermines Othello's sense of isolation as the only black man in an all-white society. His lack of familiarity with the culture of his adopted country is a critical factor in his downfall. But never mind that. Hiring the right actors from the right social group is more important than making sense of the play. A favourite approach with Shakespeare's political dramas is to set the action in a surveillance state with spy cameras everywhere and the characters strutting around like pantomime Nazis in riding breeches, military tunics and gold-tasselled epaulettes. This jackboot Shakespeare approach was a cliché 30 years ago when Ian McKellen made his film of Richard III set in an Eastern European dictatorship. But this visual idiom retains its appeal to the directing fraternity. It's rare to see a Shakespeare tragedy without a high-status character dressed up as Colonel Gaddafi or Hermann Göring. Most directors feel that Shakespeare isn't modern enough, but Kenneth Branagh, took the opposite view when he cast himself as King Lear at the Wyndhams last year. The original, set in pre-Roman Britain, wasn't old enough for Branagh, and he turned the clock back even further, to the Stone Age, an epoch that predates the invention of iron tools. This generated unexpected surprises. Branagh and his half-naked colleagues pranced about the stage in bearskin costumes, attempting to stab each other with sharpened twigs. Apart from the problems with non-lethal weapons, the show had an attractive aesthetic. It resembled a cult movie from the golden age of Swedish porn. Branagh avoided the error of overreaching himself intellectually. This temptation seems to have affected Max Webster, who created a high-concept version of Macbeth at the Donmar last December, starring David Tennant. Rather than mounting the play on a conventional stage, Webster chose to do the show as a radio drama. He took this goon show concept as far as it would go and further. The Donmar was transformed into a BBC recording studio, with the actors seated behind a pane of soundproof glass. The cast, wearing rudimentary kilts, sauntered around the place, speaking their lines softly into microphones, while the audience listened to the show on headsets hooked up to the legs of their chairs. It was bizarre to sit in a theatre watching a radio play being recorded, but any sense of annoyance soon gave way to more charitable thoughts of pity and forgiveness. One felt like a kindly parent humouring a precocious child who wants to impress the adults with a box of puppets. We mustn't blame the director or even the theatre for such experiments. Producers know that every approach to Shakespeare has already been tried at least once. To sell a show to a playhouse and to an audience, a director needs to come up with a motif that's grander, wilder, fresher, and more exciting than anything previously attempted. In a world where experiments are essential, failure is inevitable. Occasionally, someone produces a madcap idea that works. In 2022, the National Theatre staged Much Ado in a luxury hotel on the Italian Riviera during the Jazz Age. It mixed stylish costumes, thrilling music and Art Deco architecture with a raunchy nightclub vibe, and it succeeded because its aims were entirely superficial. The show set out to dazzle the senses without offering sermons on the rise of fascism or the perils of demagoguery. Sometimes, smaller ideas are better. When Derek Jacobi played Lear at the Donmar, the thunderstorm scene was done in complete silence. It was a stunning breakthrough. The Tempest is a figment of the King's diseased imagination. As an additional benefit, Jacobi was able to deliver his lines audibly, without being drowned out by an offstage wobble board. When Donald Sinden played Malvolio, he underlined the character's freakish pedantry by entering the garden, checking the sun, checking his fob watch, then he adjusted the sundial. Jude Law's Hamlet included a scene in which the unshod prince walked through a snowstorm, studying a book of philosophy. This small gesture suggested an equivalence between the barefoot prince and Christ or Socrates. Modest gestures like these tend to deliver far more drama than large-scale refurbs. That said, the cause of experimentation is always worth pursuing, even if it mostly fails to improve on the original. Even Shakespeare needs to be duffed up occasionally to see what he's really made of.
That was Lloyd Evans. Now, Sam McPhail.
The greatest rivalry in football for the past decade is coming to an end. Managers Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola clashed in 30 games across Germany and England, but neither came out decisively on top. Their final meeting was a 1-1 draw earlier this month. In May, Klopp will leave Liverpool for good. It's a shame that two of the best managers of all time may never face each other again, because their rivalry has raised the calibre of the sport so spectacularly. Klopp and Guardiola tinkered relentlessly with their squads, tweaking formations, positions and play styles in order to best one another. In doing so, they redefined the cutting edge of football season after season, and their dominance in all tournaments forced other managers to adapt their own styles so as not to fall behind. There will be much talk about their tactical brilliance in the coming months, but the man who really deserves the praise is the one who inspired them both, the godfather of modern football, Johan Cruyff. When Cruyff was a 17-year-old novice at Ajax in Amsterdam in 1965, Rinus Michels had just become the club's manager. Michels had himself developed a revolutionary attacking approach to the sport, which relied on two tenets. Players interchanging positions on the attack to confound the opposition's defence, and making runs into space between opposition's players in lieu of playing man for man. He called this approach total football. Cruyff was the perfect disciple for Michels. He was never the most athletic player, He smoked 20 a day. But he, like Michels, understood that football is a cerebral exercise as much as a physical one. Playing football is simple, but playing simple football is the hardest thing there is, he liked to say. His sayings were mocked by some, but young pupils repeated them like mantras. And they were later distilled into his 14 rules of football. The 14th was to bring beauty to the sport, which he did and still does to this day. This isn't to say total football didn't have teething problems. An overwhelming emphasis on attacking made it exciting, but also meant teams could be very vulnerable to counterattacks. The first major obstacle was in the 1969 European Cup final, where Ajax played AC Milan. The match was a clash of two rivalling football schools, Dutch total football and its antithesis, the Italian Catenaccio, or doorbolt. Mastered by Milan coach Nereo Rocco, Catenaccio was centred on a rigid system of defence that would lock out opposing teams as players then battled man for man across the pitch. The mood in the stadium was feverish ahead of the match, and kickoff was delayed by 15 minutes because there were so many members of the press on the pitch. In the Milan dressing room, Rocco barked orders at its players, instructing his defenders to kick everything that moves, if it's the ball, even better, and telling his main defender to man-mark the slippery Cruyff from the dressing room to the toilet. His team's doggedness paid off, and Milan beat Ajax 4-1. But within 2 years, after a few minor changes to formation, total football was back. Michels and Cruyff dropped a winger into a free midfield position, now recognised as a 4-3-3, and signed a new German defender, Horst Blankenberg. Blankenberg immediately fitted into Ajax's setup, where directness on and off the pitch was a prerequisite. "I'm Horst, I'm a Kraut, and I've come to play football with you," he announced on his arrival. Ajax won three consecutive European Cups, the first team to do so since Real Madrid in the 1950s. Even as a player, Cruyff experimented with the total football formula. At the 1974 World Cup, he persuaded Michels, now the Dutch national team manager, to select a different goalkeeper who was better with the ball at his feet despite being a worse shot stopper. Cruyff's reasoning was that he could also be called upon to defend in dangerous moments. The role of the sweeper keeper was born, and one that's still seen in the best teams 50 years on. Like all great innovations, this one forced change in the competition too. Michels and Cruyff's success meant that other teams had to respond in kind. As the Times reported after one of the club's European triumphs, Ajax proved that creative attack is the real lifeblood of the game, that blanket defence can be outwitted and outmanoeuvred. Cruyff became manager at Ajax then at Barcelona between 1988 and 1996, and in his first tactic session he marked the positions on the board in the classic 4-3-3 he had played in some 15 years before. "What the hell is this?" Eusebio Sacristán, a starting midfielder, later recounted. "We couldn't believe how many attackers were in the team and how few defenders." Younger players felt that total football had its day, but Cruyff started developing Barcelona's dream team, which would go on to win four consecutive league titles and the club's first European Cup. It was during the European Cup-winning season that Guardiola emerged as one of football's most promising midfielders and one of Cruyff's most loyal disciples. Cruyff had plucked Guardiola from relative obscurity at Barcelona's youth academy, La Masia, and promoted him to the starting 11, just as Michels had done to him some two decades before. After retiring as a player, Guardiola also managed Barcelona, where he bested Cruyff in holding the record for trophies won. "Before Cruyff came, we didn't have a cathedral of football," Guardiola said a few years ago. "It was built by Johan Cruyff, stone by stone." Guardiola's own tactics are very different from Cruyff's, prioritising possession and strict positional play, as opposed to free-throwing attacks. But he acknowledges the total football philosophy which he inherited. "The basis comes from before, from my mentor, from Cruyff." Although Barcelona was Cruyff's last job, he suffered a heart attack in 1991 and later quit coaching. He spent the rest of his life helping other coaches and took up advising roles at his two main clubs, Ajax and Barcelona. Just weeks before his death in 2016, he spent some time in Haifa, Israel, with the coach Peter Bosch, then a relatively obscure manager who had had limited success with some middling Dutch clubs. "In 1 week, I learned enough for 10 years," Bosch remembered fondly. Bosch has been a Cruyff acolyte since he was a child and obsessed with total football's prowess as a free-flowing attacking game. As a teenager, he collected Cruyff's sayings in a scrapbook. As a player for Ajax rivals Feyenoord, he would often spy on their training sessions to see how Cruyff's former team played. "How is it at Ajax?" he often dreamt. Sadly, he never got to play under Cruyff. Bosch was a strong defensive midfielder, a destroyer, which ironically was the opposite of the football he aspired to play. Such was Bosch's affinity with total football that when he was on the bench, he admitted that he could give himself a happy afternoon and give one to the fans. After this week with Cruyff, Bosch was offered the Ajax job for the next season. A supposed fairy tale takeover of the side started promisingly. "I never thought I'd see an Ajax team playing this way again," says Cruyff's biographer Olke Kok. But Bosch left for Dortmund that summer, where he had lasted less than a year, later followed by stints at Leverkusen and Lyon. Now back in the Netherlands at PSV and Eindhoven, Bosch is still unrelenting in his faith in total football. So far it's paying off. PSV currently have the best domestic record on the continent, 23 wins and 3 draws, and are likely to remain undefeated. It's been 20 years since a top-flight English club has managed to do the same.
That was Sam McPhail. And finally, Graham Thompson.
Roxy Music didn't make Phil Manzanera rich. Kanye West did. When a guitar phrase from Manzanera's obscure 1978 solo song, K-Scope, was sampled in 2012 by West and Jay-Z on their track No Church in the Wild. The one-third share Manzanera was given of publishing and sales revenue proved life-changing. The song featured on a platinum-selling album and was used in The Great Gatsby and numerous adverts. I would earn more money from a short guitar riff that I wrote one evening on a sofa in front of the telly than I ever earned in the entire 50 years as a member of Roxy Music, he said. Prior to the West windfall, Manzanera was hardly on his uppers. He'd experienced the standard industry rights of poor management and dodgy deals, but these days he seems to be doing all right. I'm chatting to him via Zoom from his home in West Sussex, where his nearest neighbour is David Gilmour, though it's not possible to wave a greeting at the Pink Floyd singer across a lovingly creosoted garden fence. David lives next door, he smiles. When I say next door, it's about 10 minutes' drive away. As a guitarist in Roxy Music from their eponymous debut album in 1972 to their farewell shows in 2022, Manzanera played beautifully skewed, cumbia-inflected rock guitar on all those classic songs. Virginia Plain, Do the Strand, Love is a Drug, More Than This. When Brian Ferry was off chasing solo stardom, Manzanera did his own thing, continuing an alliance with his former Roxy foil Brian Eno on several projects, reforming his school band, Quiet Sun, making solo albums, producing, curating, collaborating. The list of close associates, Eno, John Cale, Robert Wyatt, Gilmour, reads like a who's who of British innovators, a group to which he comfortably belongs. He's tricky to pin down. A former Dulwich College pupil whose fees were paid by the local authority, he's fluent in English and Spanish and can lay claim to 3 identities. Manzanera is the maiden name of his late Colombian mother and the one, you suspect, he identifies with most closely. His paternal family name is Target Adams, or so he thought, until the recent discovery that his father had been born illegitimately, outside of his grandmother's unhappy marriage, fathered in a Hastings boarding house by a Neapolitan opera singer. So really, I'm interviewing Philip Sparano. Little wonder his amiable memoir, Revolution to Roxy, cast Manzanera, 73, as a windblown troubadour. People have said that it reads more like a 17th century novel, like Don Quixote, than a music book, he says, because it's a series of adventures on my circuitous journey without any particular destination. I'm pleased about that. It's as if I'm Forrest Gump. I seem to land in all these interesting places. Long before Manzanera was a rock star, his father worked for the British Overseas Airways Corporation, BOAC, setting up new offices around the world for the airline. The family moved from Clapham to Cuba, then to Hawaii and Caracas. They were living in Havana when Fidel Castro's revolutionary troops entered the city early in 1959, heralding the end of Batista's military regime. Aged 7 at 2 in the morning, Manzanera recalls machine gun fire all around us, lying on the floor in the bathroom, pressed down by my mum. One of Batista's top generals, Tabanila, was a close neighbour. As dawn broke, 2 trucks containing Castro's Barbudos pulled up outside the house in fatigues and sealed off the whole street. 20 of Tabanila's guards were lined up and led away. Shots rang out. The general escaped, but his home was looted. While his distraught mother was keeping her children safe, Manzanera suspects his father, Duncan Target Adams, was working for British intelligence. BOAC was the government's airline, and as Manzanera points out, he had a habit of turning up at countries just ahead of their revolutions. He was due to receive an OBE when he died, prematurely, in 1966. He had people working for him who were part of Fidel's people in Havana, apparently. When he wrote Our Man in Havana, Graham Greene was in a hotel 100 yards from my dad's office. Greene was MI6. My best friend was British consul. Before he died, I showed him a picture of my dad and some others. I asked, who are these people? He said, spooks, spooks. So there was something going on. After Havana, the family moved to Hawaii, then Venezuela, whence Manzanera was dispatched to Dulwich College, a guitar-playing boarder with the 1960s on his doorstep. Growing up, I wanted to be in a band, he says. For a lot of my early childhood, I was the only sibling around. I wanted company. With Roxy Music, I thought I was joining a band like the Beatles, not in terms of artistic merit, but camaraderie. I bought into the idea of the Beatles being the Four Musketeers. There was definitely lots of fun and laughter in Roxy, but it wasn't really a band like that. It was a collective. Early on, Roxy Music pivoted around the two Brians, Eno and Ferry. Each brought a distinct aesthetic vision. Brian studied fine arts, says Manzanera. Eno went to art school, but his tutor was the same guy who taught Pete Townsend. He's way out there in a totally different kind of art world. He was a non-musician, quote-unquote, who brought conceptual ideas. I don't come from that art world at all, so how do I fit in? I'm primitive, autodidactic, just trying to make sense of what we're up to. We weren't technically incredibly proficient, but the combination of all our little bits created this textural world which Brian could inhabit. Manzanera felt all at sea when Eno left Roxy Music in 1973. The creative tensions between him and Ferry exacerbated by an undercurrent involving someone else's girlfriend. But Roxy Music regrouped and went on to make many more fine records, with Manzanera having greater involvement in the writing process. You can see why someone might grow tired of working with Ferry. Even the mild-mannered Manzanera was irked by the singer's high-handedness, making big decisions without consultation, bringing in outside musicians with no prior warning. By the early 1980s, he felt like a session player in his own band. I wonder whether there is a more unknowable rock star than Brian Ferry, the Durham minor son turned urban socialite who never quite comes into focus. The funny thing is that both he and Eno are the same people that they were when I met them, says Manzanera. It's not as though fame has changed them. Brian wants to create something beautiful, and he's meticulous. He's an artist. I get it now. I didn't really get it before. It's nothing personal. If you're a painter or you studied art, being in a band is a weirdly artificial thing. You don't get Picasso or Miro working together. They would kill each other instantly. They were all solo artists, those boys. This band idea created in the 1960s is quite a strange phenomenon. But I'm proud of what we achieved in Roxy. It seems to have some lasting legacy. We did our farewell tour, but the name, the brand seems intact. Revolution to Roxy is no kiss and tell. Manzarella didn't want to settle scores or go into too much detail about things that would upset people, he says. As for drug-fueled debauchery, it's all in other people's books. I thought, we've read all that before, what's the point? There are some pleasing tidbits, however, including a scene from the band's 2001 reformation, in which a packed press conference is severely delayed, because the band is in a suite upstairs haggling over each member's split of the lucre. Rather than chasing money, Manzanera has generally been more concerned with maintaining control of the means of production. Perhaps some of the Castro spirit seeped in. He has his own studio and label. His book is self-published and he doesn't have a manager. I've been indie in 90% of everything I do, he says. The whole point of being a musician was to be free, not to be told what to do. Though he has enjoyed the process of summoning the past, he isn't contemplating a career change. Books versus music, no contest. What tends to happen with books is that people read them once, maybe twice, but probably once, he says. How lucky are we as musicians? We wrote some song 50 years ago in 10 minutes and spent a day or two recording it. and people are still listening.
And that's everything for this week. But if you've enjoyed those pieces, why not pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine to read much more like them? I'm Oscar Edmondson, and I hope you join us again next week.